Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's Innovating California event, sponsored by Chevron in partnership with the Commonwealth Club. My name is Russ Yarrow, a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, General Manager of Corporate Affairs at Chevron, and your chair for tonight's program. It is my pleasure to introduce Wendy Kopp tonight, the founder and CEO of Teach for America and author of a fascinating new book titled A Chance to Make History, What Works and What Doesn't in Providing an Excellent Education for All. The idea for the Teach for America program was developed from Wendy's senior thesis to eliminate educational inequality in America. Now celebrating its 20th anniversary, Teach for America has more than 25,000 teachers and alumni members serving over 500,000 students across the country. Chevron is proud to partner with TFA in their efforts to build better schools, brighter students, and a stronger America. Wendy is the recipient of numerous awards, including the Distinguished Leadership Award from Northwestern University, the John F. Kennedy New Frontier Award, the Clinton Center Award for Leadership and National Service, and the Woodrow Wilson Award from Princeton University. Wendy will be joined tonight by our moderator, Dr. Colleen Wilcox, a member of the Board of Governors and past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Silicon Valley Advisory Council. Colleen is the executive director for the Alliance for Teaching and has spent 20 years as a superintendent of schools. Please welcome Wendy and Colleen.
Thank you very much for that introduction. I can't tell you how excited I am to have you with us, and I know that the entire crowd is. So thank you for being here.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Now, we haven't even spoken yet, and I have about 20 questions, so I think it's going to keep us going for a while. But the first question, I thought we'd start with a chicken and egg question, and that is, which came first? The dream for Teach for America or the assignment to write a thesis and think about what you would be doing?
Oh, good question. Really, the dream, I would say, to use your terminology, like the idea, which I had become obsessed about. Honestly, I was in a total funk my senior year in college. And in fact, I think I was officially the last senior in the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs to actually determine a thesis topic. But I was unconcerned with that for some reason. I mean, I was just literally lost. Like the notion that I was going to need to figure out what to do with the rest of my life, I was just searching for something I wasn't finding. And, you know, our generation was known as the me generation. Supposedly we all just wanted to go work on Wall Street. And I just thought that label was misplaced. I felt like I was one of thousands of people out there who were just searching for a way to make a real difference in the world. And I thought the problem wasn't the generation, it was the recruiters, like all the recruiters, which is great if this is what you really want to do. It's just that it wasn't what I wanted to do. You know, there were all these companies recruiting us to commit 2 years to go work on Wall Street or work in management consulting firms. And I'd been really focused on this issue of educational inequity, essentially, and had organized a conference on it my senior year. And it was really actually at that conference where I just thought, you know what, why aren't we being recruited as aggressively to commit 2 years to teach in our highest poverty communities as we were being recruited at the time to commit 2 years to work on Wall Street. So I then started just obsessing about it for myself. I actually started looking into teaching for 2 years. Anyway, I'll spare you, but ultimately I realized this is my thesis. This is the answer to all of my problems. my career, my thesis, everything. So ever since then, I've been sort of obsessed.
Well, the folklore is that you didn't do so well on that thesis. And I thought maybe you could tell us about what grade you got on that thesis And why you suspect it wasn't an A plus?
Actually, well, I did okay on the thesis. I mean, the funny thing is I couldn't find a thesis advisor because really more because I was such a delinquent senior, and everyone was just booked up. But some people sent me, and I don't know if any of you know Princeton or the professors there, but to an incredible man, Marvin Bressler, who was the chair of the sociology department, who's just kind of, he was legendary for his extraordinary personality and brilliance. And when I met with him, he said, no, you can't propose an advertising campaign for teachers in your senior thesis. But I'll tell you what, if you propose mandatory national service, I'll be your thesis advisor, because this was his obsession. And at that point, I just looked at him and said, okay, fine. And he agreed to be my advisor. I didn't talk to him again until I turned it in. It was called A Plan, an Argument for the Creation of a National Teacher Corps. I didn't care how I did on it. This became like I was going to go make it happen by that point. And he called me up 4 days later and said, I need you to come in here. So I go in there and he's like this. He basically said, he tells everyone, he said I was deranged, which he sort of did, but he loved it, loved it. And I got an A, so it all was fine in the end.
So it's just folklore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that was the FedEx thesis that got a C.
Oh, was that the one?
They were clearly wrong about that one, so.
Okay, well, that's good to hear. So, you wrote one book some time ago. Why a second book, and why now?
Well, my first book was, I wrote at our 10th year, and, you know, the first decade of Teach for America, like, from the idea to not only the reality, but then keeping the thing afloat, you know, lots of near-death experiences. It was just an incredible learning curve and saga to figure out how do you really put this idea, like make it happen and then create a stable institution. So at that point, I thought, I got to tell that story for all the other poor mm-hmm. social entrepreneurs who will come after me asking, how do we do this? So that book was more the story of the organization, like from idea to reality and whatnot. And I realized a few years ago that if I, meaning like 2 or 3 years ago, that if I could write a book now, it would be about something else. You know, it would be about what I've learned over time about the actual issue that we're addressing and its solvability. And what I think, based on really just the lessons I've learned from our teachers, our alumni, and the other many colleagues and leaders we work alongside in urban and rural communities about what it will take to actually solve the problem. So that's why I wrote the second book.
And the title, A Chance to Change the World, it seems to me that we all have a chance, but you actually have done it. So well, why that? Did you choose the title?
I did, you know, but actually not really. Megan Brousseau gave me the title for this book. So, you know, Megan is, you know, a second year teacher as of last year. She finished her 2 years teaching in the Bronx, and, she was teaching in her first year 112 ninth graders. And, you know, her kids were, you know, coming into her room far behind. She's teaching biology, and almost all her kids were living below the poverty line. Almost all of them had learned or were learning English as a second language. They were coming in, 20% of them were more than 3 years behind grade level in reading. They were, you know, significantly behind and had very little exposure to science. And she walked in on her first day and said to them, this is your chance to make history. And called upon them to take and pass the New York State Regents exam in biology, which is something that few students, in the Bronx actually do. She was convinced that if they did that, you know, it would be important in their lives, that it would, they realized that they could be on a college track, and they'd also prove to others that they were college material and that it would influence their course selection, et cetera, forevermore. Anyway, I recount the extraordinary act of leadership that she engaged in order to ultimately reach that goal. You know, she got her kids on a mission. She convinced them that if they worked hard enough, they could get there, that would matter in their lives. She rewrote her whole curriculum, went to great lengths to maximize every second she had in her time with her kids, realized it wasn't enough time, got many of them to come at 7 in the morning, stay till 6. She had 3/4 of them coming to school every Saturday. And a year later, 112 kids passed the New York State Regents exam in biology with a 9 percentage points higher than the New York City average. And not every kid has to take this test, so that includes all the specialized high school kids, et cetera. The book, A Chance to Make History, takes its title from her story because I think we can see in the microcosm of her example, you know, the fact that this is a solvable problem. You know, most people in America think that we have low educational outcomes in low-income communities because the kids aren't motivated, because their parents don't care. And what Megan shows us is that's not the case. You know, we saw her kids work harder than, you know, most kids in America. And we saw their parents getting them there on Saturdays, you know. So we saw her show that when you meet kids who face many extra challenges with high expectations and the extra supports they need, they excel. And that's probably the most salient lesson of the last 20 years in this, that, you know what, really, it is within our control to solve this problem.
So one of the things I think for many educators, we've been following your career and watching the program for 17, 18 years. And I think for me, one of the most impressive things is the extent to which you have studied those teachers for Teach for America that have been successful. And in your book and in your lectures and so forth, you talk about three factors that have been influenced by studying those teachers. And one is your recruitment process. One is the professional development that that you put them through and the training. And I forget what the third is, but supporting them. Mm-hmm. So let's make this a three-part question, because for all of us who've been in education for so long, we're particularly interested in the secrets that you have acquired in changing the processes and thinking about recruiting. Can you spend a little time about what you have learned about recruiting those teachers?
Sure. I mean, so I think what we learn in Megan's example and in many other teachers like her is that teaching successfully in this particular context, in our most under-resourced communities, is an act of leadership, meaning great teaching, great teachers do what great leaders do. Like, Megan stepped back and set a vision of where her kids were going to be at the end of the year and motivated others to work with her and operated in a very goal-oriented way. Like, if you spent time in her classroom, you would not be, like, witnessing a teacher going through the motions of a lesson plan, but rather would see someone who's maximizing every second to move from one point to another, and ultimately who, despite whatever challenges she met, like, oh, I don't have enough time with my kids, figured out a way around the challenge, right? So seeing that, there's something very encouraging in that, right? Because you realize, oh, this isn't about being born to teach. This isn't about a special charisma. This is about, you know, sort of all the basics. Like, it's there's nothing elusive about this. So it's something we can replicate. But understanding that has, as you say, informed all of this at Teach for America. It's led us to go out on college campuses and say, we need every additional person out there with real leadership ability to channel their energy in this direction. And we do recruit aggressively. This year we had 50,000 people applying to Teach for America. Mm-hmm. We get, you know, I don't know, 18% of Harvard senior class and 27% of Spelman senior class and, you know, to compete, to channel their energy this way. And we do that really by recruiting as aggressively as any company and maybe more aggressively. But then we also invest a lot in their training and development.
I'm not there yet.
Okay.
So I want to talk a little bit more about the interview process, because looking for someone who's going, so if I'm sitting in front of you and want to be a Teach for America teacher, what are you looking for? What are those questions that yield in your mind the kind of responses that will create a powerful teacher? teacher leader, as you often say?
Well, we've done a lot of research over time to try to understand what are the characteristics you can see at the front end that predict whether they're successful in the classroom with their kids. And so we've seen that, you know, people who demonstrate records of achievement, who demonstrate perseverance in the face of challenges, the ability to influence and motivate others, problem-solving ability, organizational ability, basically leadership characteristics are more likely than others to succeed. And there's a whole other set of characteristics around fit with this mission. People who are coming at this with high expectations for kids in low-income communities, respect and humility for others working on this issue and for families in low-income communities, and a desire to work relentlessly. So we have, you know, we test new criteria, new screens every year, and have developed a predictive selection model.
Is that public information?
Well, you know, selection models need to be, I mean, you know, but we share constantly our, you know, the high level of our lessons with school districts and other partners. The one thing I would say, though, is, so, you know, if you really think about, you know, I think Megan teaches us a lot, right? Like, she shows us we can truly solve this problem. There's nothing elusive about it. But there's something else in her example that I think is really, really daunting. And that is that, I mean, honestly, I've met very few Megans in my whole life. And Megan isn't your classic, oh, Teach for America has 8,000 Megans. Megan's, you know, the best of the best of our teachers in terms of, you know, success levels. And the fact is that for kids who are kind of stuck in today's system, your hope is to meet enough teachers who will go above and beyond traditional expectations to the extent Megan did in order to help compensate for all the extra challenges you face and all the weaknesses of our schools and school systems in the face of those challenges. But ultimately, I think what we see in her example is just clear evidence that this isn't actually the solution. Like, we're not going to solve the problem through tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of Megans because they don't exist. Like, we need to change the whole system. So I think, you know, there are limitations to the lessons we've learned. You know, we're working to build a leadership force of teachers who will, you know, help put more kids, you know, on a different trajectory, and then who will themselves take the lessons from that, the conviction, the determination, the grounding in what it takes to succeed with kids who are growing up in our urban and rural areas. You know, we need those people to take their lessons and to go out and change the system. And that's really what Teach for America is working to do. So we share the lessons we've learned, but at the same time, we really acknowledge their limitations.
So if there's one criticism that you and Teach for America has received from educators, is that you put these very capable young people through a 5-week training period. And I think I want to just peek in that 5 weeks and say, what on earth happens in that 5 weeks?
You know, yeah, I know it sounds a little crazy. It's fascinating because when you survey our school principals and ask them how they would rate the Teach for America training versus the training of the other teachers they hire, they say, you know, they rate it more highly. So, you know, I think hugely that's because it's not actually 5 weeks, right? Like, there is a huge amount of knowledge and skill, and there are mindsets that differentiate the most successful teachers. And Teach for America sort of reformed the training, right? We don't try to train our teachers in a pre-service program. We select the rare people who are ready for this, and then we invest a great deal not only in their pre-service preparation but in their ongoing professional development. And so they come to us having, you know, read our Teaching as Leadership text, having observed other teachers and gone through a set of reflections. They've engaged in local orientation sessions in their communities in which they'll be teaching. And they come together for intensive national institutes where they actually gain teaching experience. We run summer school programs in partnership with districts, and they get lots of feedback on their teaching while going through our curriculum that we've developed and continue to refine over time. But then they're clustered in schools, and we really provide 2 years of ongoing support and professional development, again, all aimed at helping people develop the mindsets and skills and knowledge that we've seen to differentiate the most successful of our folks.
I want to go into the professional development, but I'm still stuck a little bit on these 5 weeks. And could you just outline what the curriculum looks like, what day one or two looks like, and the subject matter that's covered?
I can. It's interesting because, you know, one of the key points of A Chance to Make History is that, you know, we're not going to solve this problem through recruiting and selecting and training teachers differently. We need to change the way our schools function and our school systems function. And part of that is changing the way, you know, we think about and invest in our human capital piece. So I can continue to talk about Teach for America, but it's, I really do believe there are limitations of this. As we think about what is it really going to take to fix the whole system? But for us, you know, given our mission, which is to say, you know, we need as many of our future leaders as possible to not only channel their energy in this direction, but to be transformational teachers. So the puzzle we think about every day is, how do we ensure that more of them become Megans? So what do we do in our training institute? First of all, they're surrounded by examples of the Megans of the world. And, you know, now, unlike 15 years ago or 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, we can say, here's what Megan's doing. So at least at a high level, I mean, a third of our teachers, in fact, Megan was one of these folks. I said, how did you come to teach this way? She's like, I read Teaching as Leadership. You know, some of our people can read that and walk in and do it. It's a rare person who can, and what we've learned is that there are certain mindsets, and I keep saying the same thing over and over, but certain things you need to be able to do in order to actually make it happen in your classroom. So we spend a lot of time working on those foundations at mm-hmm. the Training Institute.
And professional development, is that just a continuation of the orientation, or can you describe that in more detail?
Yeah, it's basically, I mean, we use the same framework, and we're trying to move our teachers to, you know, excellence on this teacher excellence rubric. But we have program directors on our staff who spend their time out in classrooms observing our teachers and reflecting with them on, you know, what are the root causes of the, you know, what's holding them back mm-hmm. from being all the more successful in their classroom. That's probably the core of our mm-hmm. program, but we do lots of other things as well. We have groups of teachers based on their subject areas and grade levels. We have a whole online resource community that enables folks to, you know, we have a searchable database of teaching resources that our teachers use to share both lesson plans they've created, things they've discovered from other sources. We have quite a powerful set of supports around them.
Mm-hmm. Another criticism that you receive that I think that you've been fairly successful in addressing is the notion that it's just 2 years. I think you've said that 60%, is it, of your...
Well, 60% of our... Actually, 65% of our 20,000 alums are working full-time in education, you know, half of them teaching. We have 600 school principals, growing numbers in district leadership and such. But we think it's important. I mean, I think that's important. We're never going to solve the problem unless we have long-term, sustained, committed leadership mm-hmm. from within the system. But all you have to do is teach to realize we're not going to solve this problem from within classrooms alone. Like, we need some of these folks to leave and to go out and change our policies and, you know, go into business and influence our policies and go into journalism and change the public consciousness around this problem. I share in A Chance to Make History the story of my 8-year-old interviewing me for a school paper. He's supposed to interview someone who solved a problem. And, you know, he goes through and I think we're done. And he says, you know, Mom, one more question. I don't really get it. Like, if this problem, you know, the poor quality of education in high poverty communities is such a big problem, why would you get people who are so young to just commit 2 years to solve it. This is literally from my 8-year-old. I could not believe it. But seriously, at that moment, you just realize there's something so counterintuitive about this idea. And it really does kind of come up against all of our traditional paradigms about the teaching profession, how teachers should be trained and all. And all I can say is I think we have a tendency to become immune to the crisis that is happening in our country. You know, in Oakland, 14% of African American boys graduate from high school. 14%. Right here in our backyards, in communities, in this region of all regions, right? We have, you know, we're not giving our kids the chance to have any set of true professional options. So we've had this problem for decades. 15 million kids in our country grow up below the poverty line. By the time they're in fourth grade, they're three grades behind kids in high-income communities. Half of them will not graduate from high school, and the half who do, so the kids we celebrate for graduating, have on average an eighth grade skill level. When we have big crises in the history of our country, in the history of our world, what do? We channel our most talented minds against it. And that's what Teach for America is working to do. It's working to say, you know what, we need to solve this, and what we're going to do is build a movement of our country's future leaders to do something about it.
Good for you. So you have talked, obviously, in your first book and this, about leadership. Not necessarily school leadership, but you do refer to that, or district leadership, but rather the leadership that a teacher brings to bear in the classroom. Can you define that, discuss that? I mean, certainly you can measure that by looking at the students' learning, but how can you articulate what that leadership looks like?
So, well, you know, in A Chance to Make History, I write about the fact that, I mean, despite the sort of daunting realization when you spend time in classrooms like Megan's, that this may not be the solution, like this may not be the realistic path to truly ensuring educational opportunity for all kids. What we have seen, which I think is so encouraging, and this gets us back to the leadership question, but we've seen that actually we can create whole schools that make it never easy, but easier and more sustainable to attain that kind of result. And now we're seeing whole systems effect meaningful change for kids at a whole system level. And we could talk more about what's happening in these schools, what's happening in the school systems like New Orleans and Washington, D.C. that we had given up on 5 years ago that are now the fastest improving urban school systems in the country. What's happening in those places that, you know, what does it take to actually affect meaningful change for kids? But what I think we see when you really look at the last 20 years, at any level, wherever there is change for kids that is not just incremental, and when you think about the magnitude of the problem, as I just laid it out, we need a lot more than incremental change. Mm-hmm. Like a few percentage points more kids proficient according to state standards doesn't actually affect the kind of path-changing change that we need for the kids growing up today. So we need transformational change. And wherever we have it, whether it is at the classroom level, as we saw in Megan's example, whether it is in these schools, whether it's in the systems that are moving in meaningful ways, always, 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 you have what I would call a transformational leader. And when you get into the school and system levels, what you realize is more often than not, there are people who themselves taught successfully in urban and rural areas, and as a result, believe so deeply in their kids and have such a deep understanding of what it would actually take as a result of their teaching experience that they step up and operate in ways that few other folks in influential positions actually do. And so, you know, I think it's that realization that this does take transformational leadership and the incredible power. I never would have guessed it, honestly, 20 years ago. How could you have possibly known? But I think what we've seen in the last 20 years is there's something so transformational about teaching successfully in this context. And it's that experience that undergirds real educational leadership and educational advocacy. So it's that, you know, fuels our sense of urgency to get much bigger, you know, and much better in terms of, you know, we need many more Megans, and we need to accelerate their leadership as alumni as well.
So the next question is, what obstacles, and they're talking both conceptual obstacles and actual obstacles, very practical ones, did you run into when you were starting Teach for America? And naturally, how did you overcome them?
Well, there's so many different aspects of making Teach for America work. And of course, there's the process of building the public and private sector support. Mm-hmm. And of, you know, I mean, I was, as you know, straight out of college when I started this, I had no idea how to manage a growing enterprise, and that was an overwhelming challenge. But by far the most interesting and engaging challenges, and the challenges that have kept me in this, were the challenges we've been discussing here. You know, I think, you know, it sounds deceptively simple. You know, of course, take our highest achieving recent grads, put them in our most underperforming classrooms, of course, all will be well. It turns out, not necessarily. And honestly, when I think back to our first 500 teachers, who were just every bit as committed and idealistic and talented as the folks we bring in today, you know, they went out into classrooms and saw all the challenges their kids were bringing in, and of course, their schools weren't set up to really meet the extra needs their kids were bringing in. And as a result, like, they hit the wall. And it took years for some of those folks to rise above all that and to figure out how to actually put their kids on a different trajectory. And then it took years for us to see the patterns across the folks who were actually doing that and to start being able to feed those lessons back into our system. So, you know, what's kept me in this, honestly, is seeing constantly the juxtaposition between what some of our folks are showing as possible and, you know, what I know about how far we are from ensuring that everyone is at that level.
So, Wendy, we sit in the center of this entrepreneurial community, and we often talk about social entrepreneurship as well. However, when we think of a social entrepreneur, we often think of a lone ranger with a great idea out to conquer or change the world. And the question is about knowing that there are so many other actors, if you will, in this space. How did you navigate those individuals on your way through this journey?
So many other actors, meaning other...
Educators.
Well, you know, I mean, so... When you really ground yourself in the reality of our urban and rural mm-hmm. areas and the school systems within them, you know, historically, I mean, 20 years ago when I was walking around meeting people in school districts and showing them lists of colleges where we were going to recruit, people were responding by simply laughing, like, you know, really? You think you're going to get students from Stanford to want to teach in the Los Angeles Unified School District? I'll tell you what. You make that happen, we'll hire all 500 of them. I mean, that was truly the mm-hmm. reaction. The notion, I mean, still today, and we read all the headlines and all the teacher layoffs, and certainly we wouldn't say that we're in a, you know, we have a teacher shortage today, and yet, there are still schools in our urban areas, in our remote rural regions that are very, very hard to staff. So Teach for America is an incredible ally for school districts, schools, and other institutions in our lowest income communities who know that we have a huge need for talented, committed teachers who, you know, are not going to those schools as a last resort, but rather because they want to be teaching in those schools. And at the same time, you know, when I think about all of the people out there, the people inside our school districts, the people working in and around them in pursuit of, you know, changing the system, always, I mean, there's one precious resource in this. There's one limiting factor. Get any group of education reformers from inside the districts and outside of them together and ask them, what is the great constraint? What do you think? Always. It's one thing.
Money.
No. talent, leadership. That's all. There's plenty of money, right? Like, people are getting results. People want to invest in them. And not that we don't need to spend more money, especially in the state of California, on our schools and school systems. But honestly, it's not the greatest constraint. It is talent and leadership. So we're like potential ally number one. And I think, you know, I think that's led to Teach for America's growth.
So there's two questions, and they have a similar bent here. One is, what advice would you give a reporter to help them more effectively cover education? And another question that I think dovetails with that nicely is, what's wrong with the current conversation we're having? We're asking the wrong question. What should we be asking about education?
Okay, so these are two very big questions. So to start with the first one, I mean, I said that I think there's something very daunting about understanding really, you know, Megan's example. What I think is encouraging really is to understand what's happening in these schools I referred to before. So, you know, unlike 20 years ago, today there are hundreds of whole schools in urban and rural areas, many in this general region, that are taking whole buildings full of kids whose socioeconomic background would predict one thing, and literally putting them on a different path. So we need to understand what's happening in those schools. And because some Teach for America alums really pioneered the school model that so many folks are out there adapting and replicating, and because they have a huge amount to do with, you know, growing the number of these schools, I've gotten to spend a lot of time in them. And I think my first advice to reporters and to anyone else who wants to affect change in education is, be sure you spent time in these schools. I believe that both the answer and what's wrong with the current discussion, you know, the answer is, we need to ground everything we do in what can be learned in these schools. And we unfortunately, I fear that to this day, we affect policy changes, we pursue philanthropic initiatives, we do lots of things that aren't actually grounded in the lessons of, I mean, something remarkable, right? Like, no, 20 years ago, if people would have said, yeah, hundreds of schools in our country that are putting kids who face all the challenges of poverty on a trajectory to graduate from college at the same pace as kids in high-income communities, we wouldn't have believed it. So we need to find out what is going on in those schools. So what's going on in them? In every case, there is a school leader who has embraced a different mandate than most schools embrace. So rather than just assuming that they're going to put learning opportunities in front of kids and that's their mission, they set out to, in fact, ensure that all of their kids gain academic skills and the character traits necessary to have an option to go to and graduate from college. That is a very ambitious goal in this context. And so they go after it with the same level of energy and discipline and using the same strategies that great leaders use to go after ambitious goals anywhere. Meaning, what do? They obsess day and night with their team. Like, who are they going to recruit to work in their building? How are they going to develop them over time? They build a strong culture. They work with the school faculty to build a culture of achievement in their building, just like a corporate leader would work to build a strong culture in their company. They manage aggressively, meaning, you know, this whole idea that, you know, teachers never get observed, you know, which is pervasive. I mean, literally many of our core members will never have someone come into their building unless they're maybe from Teach for America. I mean, there's some exceptions to this, but to give them feedback, no. Like, in these schools, you know, the school leader's thinking that's their job. Like, they need to manage their teachers. And then they do whatever it takes, like Megan. You know, they realize we need more time, so they lengthen the school day and lengthen the school year. They realize they need more supports for their kids, so they bring those in. So again, we realize there's nothing elusive about this. But the lessons of, and that's encouraging. I think that the lessons are, okay, so first of all, this is about talent and leadership. There's no shortcut to that. You know, like, so when we think about where we spend our energy at the district level and at the policy level, we need to be spending huge amounts of it thinking about how do we adopt the same kind of talent mindset, meaning where you think constantly about attracting and developing your people, that any highly successful organization operates with? That's one piece of it. I think there's something to be learned in the fact that these folks have assumed full accountability for actually producing outcomes, right? And either they've been given or they've taken the freedom to do whatever it takes to get there. And I think there's a huge lesson in that as well for how our policies are set up. Like, we've got a compliance culture right now driven by a set of policies at the state level and at the federal level that were designed by very well-intentioned people to protect kids. We don't trust our educators, so we tell them what to do. And they show up and they check the boxes. And unfortunately, it's not working. We're not protecting our kids, so we really need to step back and ask ourselves, you know, how do we build a different system that is in fact designed to attract and develop great educators and hold them accountable, but empower them to do what it takes to reach those outcomes. And what's wrong with the public conversation is, you know, often we're not talking about that. We're kind of oversimplifying. And, you know, if you look at the last 20 years, you know, you can pretty much say this was the year of the, and this was the year of the, now we're in the year of the teacher. It's all about the teachers. Fix the teachers, solve the problem. And yet, what we see in Megan's example is, it's unfortunately not going to be that easy, because it is very, very hard to be a transformational teacher outside of the context of a school that operates in a way that supports that kind of teaching.
Through your writings, I have a sense that you have been in thousands of classrooms. And I'm curious as to what you have taken away from visiting all those classrooms as it relates to your personal parenting.
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, I think a lot about this, of course. I mean, we all obsess over our own kids. You know, it's a very different context. And, you know, my kids have so many safety nets around them. And, you know, that's sort of the difference, right? Like, In our urban and rural communities, often kids have no safety nets. So you sort of can't afford to have, you need this kind of teaching. And I know my kids will be okay if they don't have this. But you know what? Honestly, I'm dying for teachers who will get my kids on a mission. And so that's, I don't know. I'm wishing away for that. And there are, you know, I think this kind of approach to teaching, where you think in a sort of goal-oriented way and you really ask yourself as a teacher, where are my kids now? Where do they have the potential to be at the end of the year that would be inspiring to my kids, like that would make a real difference for them? And then how do I get them to own that and assume responsibility to get there? And then, you know, to teach in such a purposeful way, it's we would all love that in our teachers. And actually, I mean, so the implication I've taken for my own, you know, parenting is I try to engage with my kids' teachers, like, so where do you think my kid is academically? And where do you think they have the potential to be? And do you think we could, like, sit down with my kid and actually talk about what the goals for the year are? There's not a lot of that kind of approach. And I've just seen, even with my own kids, it can be pretty revolutionary.
Interesting. So let's go back to leadership for a moment. Your leadership. Were you afraid of failure?
Well, as people who know me well know, I'm afraid of failure every day. But I believe so much in this. And what I've found is the key, and I've heard so many of our teachers say this too. I mean, so many of our teachers talk about the moment they realized it wasn't about them. It was about their kids. So you can sort of, you know, stop obsessing over everything you're doing wrong and your personal fears and just start thinking about, you know, am I doing the right thing for my kids right now? And like, how do we, you start focusing on them. And I think that myself, like I have to pull myself out of my own head and realize it's not about me. It's about, like, are we moving from here to there?
So, speaking about moving from here to there, you're approaching your 21st birthday, kind of a coming of age for Teach for America. And the question is, what next? I know that you have inspired Teach for India, also Teach First in England. What do you see changing in America in your program and throughout the world?
Well, there's so much. I think we have such a huge opportunity right now to, you know, build on everything that has been learned in the last 20 years. I mean, truly, we know something today that we didn't know 20 years ago. Like, we know that we really can provide kids in urban and rural areas, kids growing up in poverty, with an education that is transformational for them. We know how that happens. And so now the question is, can we scale that? To jump in and say, I mean, yes, we can. There's one question. You know, will enough people step up and say, we're going to make it happen, you know, at scale? So at Teach for America, we're working to, you know, we're trying to, in the next 5 years, double what we've done in the last 20. You know, if we can pull this off, we'll have, you know, twice as many core members out there teaching 5 years from now. We'll be about 25% of the new hires across 60 of our highest need urban and rural areas. We'll have twice as many Teach for America alums working in communities as we have today, about 44,000 of them. And because of all the lessons we've learned, you know, they'll be better trained and better supported and more effective with their kids. We'll have more of those transformational teachers. And because of what we're learning in communities about the kinds of leadership it takes to actually move the needle in our communities, we're going to be able to be all the more strategic in accelerating the leadership of our alums. So we have a big agenda in front of us in the U.S. I spend a fair amount of my time thinking about and working on Teach for All, which, mm-hmm. As you say, is the global network of mm-hmm. organizations that are pursuing this model in their countries. There are actually now 19 of them. Mm-hmm. India is one. But, you know, all over, almost, you know, we will soon be on every continent. And I'm sure in 4 or 5 years we'll be in 50 or more countries. And what I think is so... And I wouldn't have guessed this. I mean, the way Teach for All started was that I started meeting social entrepreneurs in all these different countries who were wanting to pursue this in their countries and were looking for help. And I wasn't quite sure that the lessons learned here would be that applicable. But in the end, for various reasons, we launched this. And the thing that has been so inspiring is to see the universals in this around the world. You know, the Teach for India program just graduated its first cohort of fellows actually this week. And, you know, I've talked to some of their teachers, and literally some of them are transformational teachers of the kind of nth degree, to the extent that, you know, the Teach for America core members are going to watch these videos of Teach for India fellows and be inspired about what more they can do to teach in that way with those results. And seeing how many similarities there are in what makes a transformational teacher from one context to another, is one thing that leads me to realize we're going to start learning so much from all these other brilliant teams and brilliant leaders in other countries. That's going to, you know, end up accelerating our own progress here in the U.S. and certainly vice versa. But what I'm also seeing, I feel like in the U.S., in the same way that we've seen, you know, patterns across the most successful teachers, mm-hmm. we're starting to see patterns across mm-hmm. the most successful communities, meaning communities that are improving their educational outcomes the most. Like, what does it take? What are the levers that lead communities to the tipping point? And certainly those lessons are going to inform our efforts in terms of thinking about, you know, what do we want to support our alumni to go do after their 2 years if we want to accelerate the pace of change in communities? And by the same token, you know, I've been just shocked at sort of the similarities in the kind of dysfunctions of school systems all around the world. And you can tell that the same dynamics mm-hmm. will be the case. And those Teach for India fellows are already being told to go out and do the same things that many of the Teach for America core members and alums are out there starting to do, starting advocacy organizations and running for elected office and doing various things to try to get their communities to the tipping point. And again, I just think ultimately we're going to have dozens of movements to eliminate educational inequity in countries around the world, and they're all going to be informing each other, and I think that's going to hugely increase the pace of change.
So I probably at this time should mention for our listening audience on the radio that we are talking to Wendy Kopp, founder and CEO of Teach for America. Now, it shouldn't be surprising that I have a number of questions here that relate to teaching and technology. So I'm just going to leave it rather open-ended and ask you what you have found to be effective uses of technology in the classroom, or to what extent you feel it's important to infuse instruction with technology.
Well, I mean, I'm so excited to realize out here from talking to many people in this room and outside of this room how much energy seems to be going into, you know, sort of finally this this question, because there is no doubt that we are going about this work in education the hardest possible way. We are leveraging technology almost not at all. It is a little bit terrifying to realize that any big company, I mean, approaches its work entirely differently today than they did 10 years ago. Just, I mean, it looks completely different because of the power of technology, and yet in our schools, you know, nothing has changed. I mean, we have, like, computers, laptops, hopefully teachers have them, and whiteboards, but, like, nothing has truly changed, by and large. So I think there's huge potential. I just want to caution that we need to pursue the incredible potential leverage of technology with, I think, some caution. Like, we don't want it to become the latest silver bullet. In fact, we've already let it become that and have, like, moved on to the next silver bullet. Like, when I think about the last 20 years, I you know, tell a story of the school of the future in my book, which, you know, 7 years ago, there were so many news reports and everything else. Like, we thought that this major technology company that had put, you know, tens of millions of dollars, 60 plus million dollars, and some of their best people on the project of designing, using technology to just rethink how school should be. And, you know, I went and visited the school, which is in Philadelphia. It's managed to underperform the Philadelphia public schools. And I went into the only classroom that they'll open to the public, and watched the poor teacher who'd been in the same school for the last 7 years since it opened, who was talking as loudly as he possibly could, you know, you can imagine, trying to make sure the kids are listening to him. But I stood in the back of the room and watched what the kids were doing. Every single one of them was engaged in one of three activities, and I'm not exaggerating. Two of them were taking the battery out, trying to get the computer to the laptop to start. The others were either IMing their friends or surfing the internet. And it would have been really comical if it hadn't been so devastating to realize that these are 10th graders in Philadelphia who, because of what's going on in their education, will have no real professional options that would set them up for, like, a comfortable life and to fulfill their real potential. And less than a mile away, there is a public school that has probably been in Philadelphia for decades and decades and decades, that looks just like it looked 60 years ago, that is putting its kids, like, literally all of them will graduate from high school, and they will graduate with a college acceptance letter. And so, like, what's different? You know, what's different is this school has a school leader who is on a mission to accomplish that, and has put everything into building a strong team and a strong culture, and is managing very aggressively to get there. The school of the future neglected to put a lot of thought into who the principal would be. When they finally found someone a week before it opened, they assigned the person teachers who were not picked up in the hiring process by the other schools. And, you know, we just have to be really careful. Like, technology can be a powerful tool, but it's not going to make up for it. In fact, there's an incredible quote from Steve Jobs, who I quote in my book, saying, if only it were so easy as, you know, inventing a technology application. But unfortunately, education is like everything else. The core of the solution is leadership, culture, management. So we've just got to make sure that we approach it very thoughtfully.
There are a couple of questions that kind of want to put you on the spot, and they want to know what you think would be the school districts or communities that you would give them an A, generally speaking, on their school system or the extent to which they've closed the achievement gap, and also any educators or any educational leaders that you think are really moving in the right direction.
So I want to make sure that people know what's happening in New Orleans. I think that's how I would answer this question. And Teach for America has been placing in New Orleans for 20 years. I've spent a lot of time over the years walking around the New Orleans public schools, and it's almost impossible to bring to life what it was like 5 years ago. I know we all watched the post-hurricane coverage, and people got some sense of the fact that our schools in New Orleans were not where they really need to be. But we would routinely, meet eighth graders reading at the second grade level, and it was you can't imagine putting your own kid in a New Orleans public school as of 5 years ago. And, you know, you fast forward to last spring, I spent 2 days in New Orleans, and I'd heard what was happening, and I sort of intellectually knew it would be much better than it used to be, but it was still shocking to spend 2 days going from school to school to school, not just to, you know, a few kind of boutique schools, but school to school to school to school, realizing you put your kid in any one of them because they're run by entrepreneurial leaders who are on a mission to better serve their kids. Now, the outcomes in New Orleans are not where they have the potential to be, but they are improving radically every year. So what have they done in New Orleans? Two things. So, you know, post-hurricane, when the school board decided that they weren't going to open schools for a year, the state stepped in and said, we're taking over. And they broke up the school system and created a whole system of charters, meaning anyone could apply to run a school. There are very rigorous standards for selecting who they're going to give the buildings to. And they have serious accountability to shut down the schools if they're not working for kids. So instantly they moved from what it was before, which was a compliance culture to a huge degree, to an accountability culture, right? But the people in New Orleans had been around the block many times and weren't about to let, like, the governance change become the silver bullet there. Like, they knew that doesn't create a transformational school. People do. And they put an enormous amount of energy into the human capital side of the equation, meaning they scaled up Teach for America. They launched local teacher recruitment programs. They brought in and created new principal development programs. They just went at the people side of it. Now, last spring when I was in New Orleans, I had a meeting with some of our alumni. And the conversation was just, it's been ringing in my ears ever since then, and so I just want to share a couple of the things I heard in this meeting. One was from one of our teachers who we'd placed there, I guess, 7 years ago or so, and she said, I just want to say I just bought a house. So I'm thinking, okay, why did you buy a house? And she said, I was placed here for 2 years. I was just doing Teach for America for 2 years. I wasn't going to stay in the city, but then, fell in love with the city, decided I'll stay a third year, and then one thing led to another, fourth year, but this was never home. She's like, I just realized this is home. And she said that basically, when I asked her why that was, she said, because I'm the hot commodity in New Orleans. Like, all these schools want me to teach in their buildings, and I can choose the one I want to be in that has the culture, the team I want to be part of, and well, they pay me enough. They pay me a lot. And because in New Orleans, the principals are empowered to do what they want to do with their school budgets. So that was a very fascinating part of the discussion. The other part that was so fascinating was when a number of them started saying, don't get the story wrong. Like, don't think it's a bunch of outsiders coming into New Orleans to save the day. Mm-hmm. The good people came out of the system. So I dive into that, and they say, well, ultimately, through many conversations, their whole analysis is that there were many very committed educators in the old system who were part of such a kind of, stultifying kind of culture. And literally, you start thinking you're losing your mind, but you are showing up to check the boxes. And those people in the new world became different people, coming to work, realizing their job is to you know, meet the needs of kids and move them ahead and ensure that they actually attain the outcomes they have the potential to attain. So I think that's just so fascinating and in it, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we
absolutely.
Can all do this because we have the equivalent of a hurricane in terms of the damage to human lives right now in many communities across the country. And if we decided to, we could create the advocacy organizations, elect the political leadership, create the system leadership necessary to go out and make that happen all over the country.
Thanks, Wendy. A question about resiliency. We know how important that is to a student's success in school and in life, and I was delighted that you'd actually defined it in your book, and you talked about hope, grit, and zest. And I thought, can you measure that?
Well, actually, I mean, we're working with some researchers at the University of Pennsylvania who are, you know, this is their field, and in fact, they have a whole network of selection experts around the world who are working to develop measures around this, both to look at for those characteristics actually at the teacher level, but also at the student level. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of folks out there working to identify the character traits that differentiate kids who actually make it through college, like focused on, and not only make it through college, but ultimately succeed in life based on a number of different metrics. And I think there's lots of hope in that because we all know that just attaining academic skills doesn't produce people who all make it in life. And I think if we can round out our understanding about, you know, what it really takes to fulfill your potential, we can start ensuring that we're driving at a more holistic set of outcomes in our schools.
Wendy, you have been a great inspiration to me and to many educators and to many non-educators throughout this country and throughout the world. And we only have time for one more question. Unfortunately, I've got about 30 left. But let me ask you, who has inspired and influenced you?
You know, I have to say, the people who've inspired and influenced me really are, you know, the Megans of the world, the Chris Barbicks of the world. You know, Chris started teaching in Houston, and I really do think about him and many others like him when I think about, you know, what has inspired me in this, like, why am I still at it? Why do I feel the sense of responsibility, the sense of urgency I feel today? I mean, Chris was one of those unsuspecting Teach for America Corps members who was going to teach for 2 years in Houston, who's now running a whole network of these very high-performing schools. When he opens his fifth high school in 2014, his schools will graduate as many kids in Houston as the entire Houston Independent School District. He gets extraordinary, extraordinary outcomes. And I just think about, he's been going at this for 20 years. It's been incredibly challenging. But I look at that and I just think, you know what? Time and perseverance and real commitment to your kids just pays off in the end. So that's what inspires me in this.
On behalf of all of those children that you have changed their trajectory, I thank you and our audience thanks you for all you've done.
Thank you.
We hope you all enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Wendy Kopp, founder and CEO of Teach for America and author of A Chance to Make History, What Works and What Doesn't in Providing Excellent Education for All. Dr. Colleen Wilcox, Executive Director of the Alliance for Teaching, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you. Wonderful job.